Cultivating Place is made possible in part through the generosity of the Caddo Shaw Foundation. This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. Sarah Raven is something of a superstar in the garden world, especially when it comes to good, homegrown food, beautiful, colorful flowers, and elegance in presentation generally. I was fortunate enough to interview Sarah for my 2020 book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants, and I am so pleased to finally welcome her to the Cultivating Place program this week to share more about her newest book, A Year Full of Pots, Container Flowers for All Seasons. In the past 25 years, Sarah has been a leadership voice in beautiful and productive gardening through her trial and working garden at Perch Hill, through her many books and in-person educational offerings, and now through the popular podcast she hosts with the delightful Arthur Parkinson. In anticipation of Mother's Day, graduation season, and the fun of our summer gardening ahead, Sarah, I'm so pleased to be speaking with you this fine spring week. Welcome to Cultivating Place.
Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm much looking forward to our chat.
Your career is long and richly seeded, let's say, with so much botanical and gardening and horticultural interest. But I'd love to have you introduce yourself to listeners with kind of a distilled version of how you see the importance, maybe most globally, of your impulse to garden.
I think, what got me gardening was nature. And so I spent a lot of time as a child with my father, who's a botanist. He was called John Raven. And he took me around the United Kingdom and Europe quite a bit. In fact, we spent a lot of time in Italy and Greece, different islands, Rhodes and Crete and Corfu, botanizing. And so from a very young age, I loved and felt most peaceful and happy in places with beautiful wildflowers. And then in my teens and 20s, obviously, that receded in my kind of priorities, I suppose, inevitably, with working. I trained to be a doctor. I then became a junior doctor. I then had a young family. Anyway, I then sort of rediscovered again through wildflowers my sense of peace and happiness in beautiful wild places. Mm. And so botanizing with my husband, Adam Nicholson, in Crete, that's kind of where I got into it, and then started making the garden here as a result of that reconnection with nature. And that's what I would suggest, particularly if you have children or grandchildren, really regularly immersing them in natural beauty is certainly totally informed the person that I am and what I've done. I'm now 61, and so what I've done since my early 30s. And so, if that answers your question, I'm not quite sure, but that's how I got into it.
Yeah, and I think what I'm hearing is that one of the important threads for you is that nature has been important to you. At the heart of that nature is a love for botany, and that there's an interface there with our gardens.
Completely. I suppose the thing about nature and wildflowers and botany is that it tends to be a little more transient. So in the UK at the moment, the snakes and fritillaries are absolutely magical in the Thames Valley, but they're over in 3 weeks. And similarly, the incredible orchid woods in Kent, with lady orchid and things, they're over quite quickly. And I suppose that's why I became attracted, not more, but equally to gardens, because the great thing is with the improvement from plant breeding and from plant importing from, you know, places like California with you and South Africa and Mexico, you have plants that are in the same families as the ones you may see in the wild, but they have a longer flowering season, or they've been hybridized with something that gives it a longer flowering season. So sort of a really good garden plant, you might see flowering for 4 months, which would be very unusual in nature. And so that's why, in a way, using the natural world as your foundation stone and kind of learning schoolroom, classroom, is a very good basis. But then it morphs easily into being a gardener. And I think one of the things I feel very lucky about is Latin names for me are not an issue, because I was brought up with them almost sort of bilingually, in a sense, in that I was very young when I started rattling off all the Latin names, because of course wild plants do have their common names, but when you're keeping a wildflower diary, as I did, you have to put in their Latin name first. And like the first one in my wildflower book when I was seven was Agrimony, and its Latin equivalent, which is very similar. Anyway, so I've been lucky that I don't feel intimidated by that. And what I would say is I just don't think it really matters, the Latin name thing, but I think plant ident is really important, just so that you feel in a world that is very welcoming and that you know about and is not alien in a way. So I think one of the first things I always say when I'm teaching beginners is just try each week to maybe take a photo on your phone or cut out a picture and put it on the wall or whatever of 10 plants a week. And learn them, learn their Latin name, learn a little bit about where they grow in nature, because that's where they'll thrive in the garden. And if you do 10 or maybe 12 a week, you know, by the end of the year, you've learned an awful lot of plants. And you know, that may be enough. Do you know what I mean? In most gardens, you may not need any more than that. I mean, 520 plants is plenty.
Is a lot, is a great palette to start from. And I think... if you and I are any indicator, once you start learning them, it's really hard to stop, actually, because you then see them on the verges or in the meadows or in someone else's garden, and you're like, wait, what is that one? And it kind of looks like this one. Is it the same family? And it is this wonderful world that once you get your toe in, is it just unfurls before you for the rest of your life. And to even hear you say that your snake's head fritillary are in bloom, ours bloomed, our native version, Fritillaria affinis, is a few weeks past, but to know that you have a relative and I have a relative and we are this far apart is reminds us of this common ground, right?
Yeah, very, very much. And I love that. I mean, as I said at the beginning, one of my happiest places is going on botany trips and wildflower trips. And I love the fact that I can relate what I see in Greece or Italy or in America or in South Africa. And I may not know the exact species, but I know the family immediately that it comes from. And that is, it feels very kind of cozy and familiar. And there are new plants too, where you go, but you may know them from your garden. So I remember being on a walk in South Africa and seeing these incredibly colourful carpets of what I knew immediately was an Amesias, whereas we don't get them in the wild here. But I immediately came back and bought lots more Amesias because I had a sort of newfound affection for them and could see that there they were thriving in the wild in a very dry environment, you know, no one watering them or deadheading them, and they were performing so well. And so exactly as you say, it's very reassuring, isn't it, that that, you know, if you maybe learn, I don't know, you know, let's cut that in half, so 200 families of plants, and you already know, everybody already knows rose and buttercup, and you know, you'll already have many at your fingertips. It feels very rewarding, I think.
Yeah, very definitely, and very, very connecting in a time in our world where so much feels disconnected. This is such a human connector. And but I want to go back to something you said about the ephemeral nature of those plants we learn to love and know in the wild, and how what's interesting to me about that, Sarah, is how that is part of why we love them. What makes them so precious is that ephemeral nature. But I love that bridge you used from then being able to bring it closer to home, make it a little longer lasting, a little more curated in our gardens. And that back and forth as well is such a human one.
Yeah, very much. I mean, I've just got back from a four-day trip to Holland, to the Netherlands, on a tulip hunt. I go every year. I go three times a year, once for the tulips, once for the annuals in June, and once for the dahlias in August, September. But and the thing there is, I've rather fallen in love again with the species variety of tulips, because they're very resistant to something that we had a big problem with in the spring last year in the UK, which is tulip blight, which I hope it isn't a problem like it is with you, but because it was very wet. Anyway, so I had a newfound respect for them and loved them. But of course, the hybrids that lots of us grow in our gardens, the garden hybrids, the Darwin hybrids, or the Triumphs, or the Parrots, or the Lily Flower group, which are hybrids, do actually flower for much longer. So, you know, I love a good range, but there is no doubt that hybridizing things can give greater longevity in their garden performance. And and you know, as well as bigger flowers, etc. So it's not always an improvement, but it actually often is an improvement. And so it reminded me, with seeing all these beautiful species tulips, that I love them, but they, you know, they really only flower for 2 or 3 weeks, whereas some of the hybrids, I mean, particularly the doubles, really, really flower for twice that long.
Right. And it reminds us why we as humans, right, have been doing this for hundreds of thousands of years, selecting the plants we want, crossing them to get something else we might want. And I think one of the things you highlight in that story right there about the tulips is that there is importance in supporting and caring for both our original species and native wild progenitors, but also the very best of the hybrids we have. Because if we keep all of the genetics safe and healthy, when there comes a problem like tulip blight or all of the other ones you can think of, then we have the genetics to go back and reinvigorate lines that we love.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. And I find the sort of speciesist person, you know, there are certain gardeners that are very sort of snobby and only want to grow the species tulips and the species narcissus. And there are other sort of more flamboyant florists who only want to grow the hybrids. And I get both points of view, but I'm much greedier than that. I want to have a good range between the two. And just as you say, it gives a garden more a robust nature. Because, you know, last year we had fewer species, but quite a few in the grass, and they thrived and looked wonderful. Whereas, to be honest, a lot of the hybrids really didn't. Whereas this year, interestingly, the pots in which contain the hybrids are looking really spectacular. And luckily, we haven't had tulip blight. And whereas the species have already pretty much gone over, because we had quite hottish March. So do you know what I mean? It's like I'm really lucky that I have both. And I feel just the same about edibles. I mean, I grow a lot of edibles here, and I always grow things like salad rocket and Mizuna and some of the mustards and flatleaf parsley in a greenhouse here. But I also always grow exactly the same mirror image of plants outside, because if we have a very cold and potentially wet, but maybe very cold winter, the inside ones do fine, the outside ones don't. Whereas if we have a really wet winter, on the whole, a wet, warm winter like we've had this one, you know, the outside ones have done almost as well as the inside ones. But at least I've got the backup, which is whatever the weather does, I'm going to be able to pick salads. So if I've got a little bit inside, a little bit outside. And that, again, it's the same varieties, but I'm just slightly altering their growing environment, and it gives me greater longevity.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. Sarah Raven is a world-renowned gardener, plantswoman, and tastemaker. She's joining us this week from her home and working garden known as Perch Hill in southeast England. We'll be back for more after a quick break. Stay with us. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by the Cato Shaw Foundation, funding initiatives that empower women and help preserve the planet through the intersection of environmental advocacy, social justice, and creativity. Hey, it's Jennifer. Happy May, gardeners. We've made it to this point in the season, this beautiful point in our circle around the sun. It has been something of a trying first few months of 2024 in my life, but here we are. And as I write, I am companioned by a large bouquet of life and beauty, colorful fruit and form from my very own garden, sitting on my desk beside me. Delicate iridescent pink gladiolas, big, flouncy, fragrant show-off roses like Winchester Cathedral and Sheila's Perfume, and a deep magenta gnarled old climber whose name I have lost, but whose fragrance is so satisfying every spring. Native purple sage and coral bells fill out the bouquet, and they fill out the garden where these all grow together. Together, these plants and flowers and their relationships with me and with this place over these many years, in the vase and in the ground, they remind me that the flowers of this world make so much more bearable. Don't forget to stop and smell them. We're back now to our conversation with Sarah Raven, British gardener and plantswoman. As we come back, Sarah tells us more about the germination story of her garden and garden work life at Perch Hill, including years living and writing at Sissinghurst, the historic home and garden of Vida Sackville-West, to whom Sarah is related through her husband's side of the family. We go on to dig into the germination story for her newest book, A Year Full of Pots.
We moved here actually 30 years ago, on the 4th of May, 30 years ago. We left London, where I was a medical doctor at Charing Cross Hospital in West London. And we lived here for 10 years. And then my father-in-law died over at Sissinghurst. And so we went and lived there for 8 or 9 years. And then we came back here about 8 or 9 years ago. So, but I always had the garden here, and I always had the seed business and the dahlia business that I started when I had my second child, Molly, in 1996. I didn't actually garden at Sissinghurst because the National Trust have their own gardeners. And I was still gardening back here at Perch Hill. But I took real inspiration from the place and being in the garden in the morning and the evening, which, of course, is the greatest time to be in any garden. And I absolutely loved it. But interestingly, I actually wrote a book about the garden and Sissinghurst and Vita, with quite a lot of Vita's writing. But I couldn't actually do that until I was about to leave, because I felt too close to it. But with the knowledge of the distance of leaving, I was able to celebrate it more in a way. But actually writing about one's home felt a bit too intimate. And anyway, then we came back here, and I am just incredibly lucky that I combine experimentation, which is something that I firmly believe in. I don't want to live in a garden that is that stays the same from one year to the next. I have a restless mind. I love learning. And so we trial probably 100, 150 new plant varieties here every year. So they're not 150 different families, but and from that, both me and our head gardener here, Josie Lewis, we learn enormously every year from our experimentation. And whether it's experimenting about techniques or whether it's experimenting about varieties, we want to find the very best. And I have an online nursery, and I only want to sell what I have found to be the very best, whether it be a Phlox paniculata or a Cosmos. And so we'll try and pull in every Cosmos that's currently available on the market throughout the world. A lot come from Japan currently. And we will do a whole big, maybe 20 by 20 foot patch of just Cosmos. And we will monitor how much we pick from them, how much the bees visit them. Do they get rust, which some do? How tall do they get? Do they flower prolifically from early or not? And we try and visit the trial patch once or twice a week and record things so we can compare the same family across its whole range. And that's basically what's informed this garden here. So very unlike most gardens that can be visited by the public, which are about creating intense beauty if you're Sissinghurst, or intense excitement if you're Great Dixter, two gardens quite local to me. Here, it's about being sort of on the button of new varieties. And I hope it's beautiful.
Oh, it is.
I hope it's exciting.
It is.
But the point is, it is a sort of a glorified trial ground in a sense. And it's also a glorified production. It's my shop. I mean, I'm about to cook dinner for Arthur Parkinson, actually, who's just turned up, who's going to help me teach tomorrow on a course. And I haven't done it yet, but I'm going to go for a walk and I'm going to pick lots of different salad leaves and not yet some tomatoes. So I'm going to get them frozen ones out of the freezer from last summer, and I'm going to make a pasta dish with a salad, you know. But so we grow a lot of productive plants here too, whether they're cut flowers or edibles.
And it is both beautiful and it is exciting. And there's something about the constant process and research and reevaluation with all of your passion, Sarah, that makes it all of those things. It's just a very dynamic and welcoming mission and space. And I think that is also fully embodied in the newest book, A Year Full of Pots. Now, this is like your 100,000th
yes.
book, and it follows a sort of sister book, if you will, A Year Full of Flowers. And it's kind of giving the expertise of your many years of experimentation and experience and data collection and providing it to those of us who might not have that and who might want to put it to work for things like flowers and for pots. So let's get to this newest book, because it's very, very beautiful. And what I love about it is that it is so incredibly flexible, because you can have three pots, or you know, on your stoop, or like you can have in the hundreds of pots across many, many acres. So what was the catalyst for you for this newest book? Why did you feel it was needed? And why did you think you had particularly good insights you wanted to share that would be new for people, right?
Yeah, I think that I've been gardening for 30 years quite, you know, every day. And I'm pot gardening for probably 20. And because we have nearly 400 pots across the garden here, I have tried, you know, grown each year maybe 400, 500 different pot species. And actually, you could probably even double that if you include bulbs and tulips and stuff, because obviously there are two seasons. And so I just felt like I probably knew as much about growing plants in pots as kind of anyone, in a sense, and that I just trod the tiles a long time. And because, again, Josie Lewis is the head gardener, she's really always been fanatical about pots. So it's only after she arrived that we really built up our pot collection and built up our trialing. So we do a total changeover twice a year. We do a total changeover in May, where we're moving from the bulbs into the tender stuff like dahlias and half hardy annuals and annuals. And then we do another total changeover in October into November. We have very few permanent pots, so we do have a few sort of hydrangeas and rosemary and, you know, buddleia. There's some compact buddleias, the Buzz Lavender series and the Dreaming Lavender series, that are, of course, there from one year to the next. But most of our pots have a changeover. And so we you know, I've learned a lot over the last decade and a half. And I'm someone that if I know something that I think other people are interested in, I don't want to hold on to that. I want to share it because, you know, in a sense, that's what gardening's all about. If you're with fellow gardeners, is to share your knowledge. And my father was a teacher. I mean, a university teacher, but I love teaching. I love communicating. And also, I'm lucky enough in that I've worked with the same photographer, Jonathan Buckley, for 27 years. So again, he reminded me of it the other day. So 27 years, 3 weeks ago. And he has visited this garden every 2 to 3 weeks for 27 years. So I have the most incredible portfolio of photographs of things looking at their best. Because of course, he's not going to photograph them when they're looking awful. And so, you know, he's arriving very early on Saturday morning. And we tend to do our shoots at weekends, because we can concentrate with no one else around. So it's just him and I. And we'll then shoot all the tulips for 3 days. And then he'll be back again about 10 days later. And then we have a little pause until the roses come out.
Yes,
do you see what
yeah.
I mean? So my books are not dictionaries. They are very, very personal, subjective. You know, the things that I have found to be particularly good. But because I have one of my closest friends lives in the Hudson Valley in the States. And we talk a lot, and she's a great gardener. And so I try and extrapolate from her experience of what does well there too with you in the States or in Europe, you know, in a drier situation, et cetera. But I mean, it was interesting, actually. I read a review of my book, quite a negative review, and luckily it was the only one. But it was somebody who said, oh, and she hardly even mentions roses. She only mentions one. It's true, because I have had very poor experience of growing roses in containers. They get black spot, they don't look healthy, they don't flower very well for me. And so I don't mind being accused of not being inclusive, because this isn't a dictionary. Mm-hmm. It's a subjective story of what I can report the trials and experiments have done exceptionally
right,
well.
Right.
And it just happens for me to not be roses.
Well, and this was also, I think, very heartening for me, coming from a very hot, dry summer climate, a cool, wet winter climate here in Northern California. And it's one of the things that attracted me to the book, is that I can take information about potted plants and tweak anything I need to make the climate more amenable with the potted condition, no matter if it's coming from you in a very different climate in England to mine here. And that, again, is one of the great joys of container gardening, is that you have greater capacity to make changes to keep a wider range of plants really happy with exposure and drainage and feeding and watering, you know, or not watering. All right, so let's get to the book, because you take a similar approach as you did to A Year Full of Flowers, and you give us a very beautiful introduction. We're going to talk about some of the components you talk about in the introduction, and then you walk us month by month through the year on what your work is, what your planting is, what your maintenance is, and what things are looking like. And it's lovely because it gives us a chance to understand, like, to break down in bite-sized chunks, what if I really want stunning pots this year throughout my garden, these are some things I can work on in each month. Or you alter that a little bit if my seasons are just a tiny bit off from yours. I can extrapolate from your calendar to mine, which is lovely.
I mean, I'm a real believer in broad brushstroke rules. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I feel is incredibly important in my pot book is about the palette.
Yes.
And I describe these four different palettes. And genuinely, again, that has come out of 25 years of looking at Jonathan's photographs, things that we've done together that I've planted and he's then photographed. And I feel I know in my gut what works and what doesn't work for me. But I think genuinely having a feeling for a sense of beauty, I suppose, if that doesn't sound too arrogant. And so I, from that, have broken down pretty much the four color range into these four palettes. One is dark and rich, which are the sort of Venetian velvets, crimsons, mahogany browns, deep sort of ginger snap colors, and rich purples, the Venetian velvets. And then the second palette is the boiled sweets, which are like a jar of boiled sweets. And if you add blue into them, it then becomes stained glass, which of course we don't have blue boiled sweets because we wouldn't eat them. But so, and those two have a common factor in them, which is that they have almost no white in them. They're very, very saturated. And if you're a painter and you use pure pigment in your paintings, these are the ones where it's very, very pure. And then the second two palettes have a high concentration of white. So they're the reverse and they are the pastels. But I divide them into the soft and warm, which is the warm tones mixed in with sort of 95% white, so just a dauber color, or the soft and cools, which are the things where the cool colors are mixed with white. So with soft and warm, you get cafe au lait, you get apricots, you get peach. And with the soft and cools, you get mauve, you get pure white, and you get a very sort of cool, the cool pinks. And what I find when I'm teaching is that if I can get people to do their designs within those palettes, they always work. And it's not too busy, but it hangs together. It hasn't got too much going on. And I almost always use a recipe within those palettes where I choose a dominant flower, a dominant what I call a bride, the sort of blousiest of them. And then that is in one color and in the palette. And then I would choose a slightly smaller flower that I call the bridesmaid, that backs up the bride and doesn't compete with the bride. But, and you could have five bridesmaids, but they all need to be in the same outfit as the bride, and but just smaller. And then I always use what I call the gatecrasher.
I love the gatecrasher.
And it's the key, you know, it's the color, little bit, just a sprinkling of contrast, of kind of naughtiness, and it brings the whole thing to life. And whether you're working with rich crimsons, it's using a boiled sweet orange as your gatecrasher, or whether you're using pure whites, it's just putting a little bit of a kind of misty, mauvey color through it, or it could be a richer blue. But just having that zap of something else really does... just liven it and enliven it. And, you know, whenever I analyze a successful border, a successful flower arrangement, or a successful pot combination, if it follows those rules, it sticks within the palettes, but you've got a gatecrasher breaking through the main color, it really works very, very easily.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. Sarah Raven is a world-renowned gardener, plantswoman, and tastemaker. She's joining us this week from her home and working garden known as Perch Hill in southeast England to share with us more about her newest book, A Year Full of Pots, Container Flowers for All Seasons. As Sarah notes in the introduction to the book, good container arrangements and planting combinations in the garden are like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. You've got to love that. We'll be right back for more with Sarah after a quick break. Stay with us. Hey, it's Jennifer again. So I will admit that after reading A Year Full of Pots and conducting this interview with Sarah Raven, my plans for my summer potted combinations have gotten a lot more complex and adventurous. So thank you, Sarah Raven.
In two large dark terracotta pots at the front of our driveway, I have combined the silver foliage and spiked deep purple flowers of phenomenal lavender with the frilly bright green foliage and burgundy pom-poms of burgundy pincushion flower. These are both skirted by a bright green lemon thyme that should cascade over the side. I'm not at all sure who is the bride and who is the bridesmaid here, but I think the lavender is the bride. In another pot, I've combined short, colorful zinnias interplanted with a mid-height Hopi dye sunflower. These are underplanted with a woolly thyme and white alyssum. And in two additional pots in the full, hot summer California sun, I've done two kind of gravel garden pot combinations. These have Dittany of Crete thyme, which I have killed before because of too much water. And I have paired these with a low-mounding, bright pink-blooming erodium. This should be a good gravel garden show trial, and these are situated on our deck with two other pots filled with only the cascading, dry-loving, Southwest native, honey-scented Blackfoot daisy, Melanpodium leucanthem. They are so cheerful, and the butterflies and bees are cheered by them too. We'll see how they hold up to a California summer in a pot. It's not the 150 new plants Sarah and her team under head gardener Josie Lewis trials at Perch Hill every year, but these are making me happy and I am sure they will keep me plenty busy. How the heck does Perch Hill do it all? You know, I was really struck in the middle segment of this conversation with Sarah when she noted in passing something about whatever your mood is this season. And it really resonated with me as a truth we might overlook sometimes. Because my mood, say for instance, that first summer in my first garden as a young adult, was so very different than my mood and capacity the first summer in my garden with a newborn, or this coming summer and the garden and pots, which are definitely already tinged with missing my mother who has been dead 30 years, missing my father who passed in March, and now even missing my sweet kitty cat of 16 and a half years, who passed after an intense week of hospice care just 2 weeks ago now. Every season of our lives brings a different mood to the seasons of our gardens and plants and trails, right? It's good to remember this, to notice it, and to emotionally and energetically allow for it. So wish me luck. I'll post photos of anything that comes out really well, or maybe even anything that comes out really badly. What about you? Are you experimenting with any new plantings or combinations? Remember to take photos. Think of Sarah Raven's legacy of 27 years of photographs by the same photographer documenting what Perch Hill has looked like over this long period. That is an incredible archive that tells a rich and complex story itself. Let's remember to do the same for our own gardens. We're back now to our conversation with gardener and plantswoman Sarah Raven, author of the recently released A Year Full of Pots, Container Flowers for All Seasons. As we come back, Sarah and I are speaking more about the emotional call and response of flowers, of colors, and of the color palettes she has encouraged us as gardeners to try in our pots in our gardens. This description you've just given us of these palettes really comes back to something you write early in the book, which is that the most crucial design point for you is color, and that when we combine colors in pots and across pots, that is where you and Perch Hill really hit your stride in your experience with them. And it comes back to something that I kept sort of underlining as I went along through the book, Sarah, and that is that these palettes create sort of an emotional response from us. And it's that emotive context that is partly what makes them work.
Yes, because if you've got all of them together, it's a bit, oh, I don't know where I am. I don't know how I'm feeling. This is like, this is jolly. This is sad. This is, you know.
Right.
And that's why I think it's absolutely key who you are and also slightly what mood you're in that season, I think.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, for instance, the rich Venetian velvets were absolutely, they are still my core palette. So I've just been in Holland. I've been marching across fields and fields and fields of tulips, but I'm always drawn to those ginger snap, kind of slightly strange, slightly murky, earthy colors. Whereas I am not naturally emotionally drawn to the soft and cools, which I think of all of these as sort of characters, and I think of that as a Champs-Élysées, very chic Parisian in stiletto heels and a pressed black skirt. And for me, that is not who I am.
Yeah.
And so, not surprisingly, I really love that palette in certain places. I love it in a dark corner because it's like shining a torch into the corner. And I also love it rolling out to the countryside because, particularly at this time of year, the fields that I'm surrounded by, covered in dew or perhaps frost, have that colouring. And when you have a few pom-poms of sheep out there too, if you're moving from the whites and the ivories with the occasional splash of pink, it sort of merges into the countryside. Whereas the rich Venetian velvets would look all wrong there, and they look wonderful in a terracotta yard that we have here.
Right, right, right.
And the boiled sweets I have in what's called the Oast Garden here, because it's absolutely in the heart of the place. It's the real beating heart. It's between all the buildings. And it's jolly and uplifting and kind of light on its feet and celebratory. And I want that. You know, it makes me sort of smile. It feels lovely. And then the other palette, the soft and warm, I very much use through the rose garden in spring, because rose foliage emerges crimson and copper. And to have then these soft café au lait colours, like the very famous tulip called La Belle Époque, having that with perhaps some of the warmer ivories, so not cold whites, but the warmer ivories, and the warmer apricots, like there's a tulip we use a lot here called Apricot Fox, which is very lots of white pigment mixed in to make it the orange, chalky. Whereas Ballerina Tulip, Ione, which is bright, just like an orange boiled sweet, we use that a huge amount in the Oast Garden, which is the boiled sweet garden. And so each palette has a place here. I struggled, as I mentioned, with the soft and cool. But now I love it as much as all the others because it's now found its right place. And it fits it with this place. And it's the right, it's the garden that's lit most in the early morning. And it looks absolutely beautiful. And I wouldn't want a rich saturated palette in that situation. So it's really, I mean, color and how you use it is so important to me. So I would really, really encourage everyone to be confident in their use of color. And that's why I find me outlining the palettes on a double page spread so you can see it really clearly. Because it is, people who are cautious or perhaps a little conservative, who might want to paint their walls magnolia or white or whatever, and perhaps wear very tasteful sort of cashmere greys and taupes and things, what they tend to feel fearful of using colour. And actually, colour is just such a life enhancer, and it doesn't have to be scary if you have a few rules up your sleeve. And that's why, for me, the book was such an important thing to write, because I teach people not every day, but two or three days a week in the spring and autumn season. And I find people just need to be helped to feel confident. And having that bridesmaid gatecrasher, cutting out pictures and putting them together on a map of your garden, and then perhaps having tracing paper or baking parchment overlaying your map, and so then working out what's going to be looking lovely in March and April, and then another sheet, what's going to be looking lovely in May and June, and then another sheet, okay, let's move on to the next couple of months. And then having a look at it as a whole and seeing, do the palettes work for me? Do I love this? Can I imagine this in my head? And I find that little bit of planning in the winter is a lovely, again, heartwarming, uplifting thing to do when there's not much growing. So that's what I encourage everyone to do.
One of the things you mentioned again early on, which I want to quickly touch on, is the idea of green not being a color. Talk a little bit about that in terms of how you're thinking about pots, Sarah.
Yes, of course. I have a famous gardening godmother called Penny Hobhouse, or Penelope Hobhouse, who some of you will have heard of. Anyway, she, I remember saying to me when I was quite young, Sarah, you should only design gardens that look as good in black and white as they do in color, and take a photograph in black and white. And if it works like that, it'll be beautiful. And that's what you need to aim for. Well, I couldn't be more different. And I love her dearly, but I don't believe that. I do believe the bones are really important. I believe the pots that you use, and I don't use brightly glazed pots. I use either zinc or terracotta. But I don't, as I look out the window now, green is a very calm thing. And if it's very strong acid green, you do have to think of it as a color, like euphorbia green. But most greens are very, they do, they're the perfect backdrop and the blue sky. And then it's how those palettes relate to the greens. But I don't use green because I'm taking for granted the foliage of the plant. But and the foliage of the plant and its shape and its texture is sometimes in the recipe, but only if it is making a statement, which actually tulip foliage is pretty boring, to be honest. So I'm not thinking about that at all when I design a combination. And, you know, even something like a dahlia, the foliage is unexceptional. I don't think of it at all. I literally think of the flower. And the flower color and the flower form and the habit of the plant. And so, yes, for me, green is not, a lot of people say white is invisible. White is the noisiest color in a garden. It draws attention to itself. If you walk into a garden with a white plant 50 foot away from you, your eye will go to that first before anything else. Whereas green, that is not the case. It doesn't happen because it's all around us.
Now, you have a beautiful system there at Perch Hill, which I think is worth talking about, so that you can make your switch outs from season to season. In May and June, certainly early mid-May is one of these seasons for most of us where things are looking a little bit on the tired side from spring, but we're not ready yet for full summer. Tell us about the quick switch system you use there, because it makes, I think, a pot, if you really want a few pots to do a lot of work for you across your garden and the seasons, this is a trick, a hack, if you will, to make it happen much more seamlessly.
Yeah, so for our bigger pots particularly, we actually hide within them black plastic inners, which they're made from very strong plastic. And so they're reusable for about 10, 12 years. So there isn't an issue about the sustainability. And if we have a very handsome terracotta or metal pot, we will try and find a container that fits immediately just perfectly inside, but sits a little bit below the rim. So you don't actually see the pot. You just see the compost and the plants. And what we do is, as soon as the tulips are beginning to look a little ropey, we lift that container out and either plant the tulips in the cutting garden or perhaps store them to plant again the following autumn. But in the meantime, 6 or 8 weeks before, I will already have planted, let's say, a dahlia with some half-hardy annuals in exactly the same black plastic inner. So out that goes the very same day and slots in. And it might not quite yet be in flower, but it almost is. Yeah. And so it's a way of just going into a succession. And the other thing that we do a lot through the spring season is that we do these things called bulb lasagnas. So the smallest and earliest bulb goes in the top like an iris reticulata, and then you go to a narcissus in the next layer down, next size down, and that flowers a little later. And then you go to a tulip in the next layer down and perhaps another tulip below that. And by doing that, if you have a tiny garden, like my two daughters live in London, they only have balconies, I create these pots for them. And they then have something that looks pretty good from the middle of February till the middle of May. Then you take that whole thing out and you slot in your dahlia and annual combination, which takes you through until October. And then the bulb pot goes back in. And so without spending a huge amount of money or without having huge amounts of space, you've got quite a nifty way of having a really handsome looking pot pretty much year round.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love the lasagna recipes. And I've tried them before with just maybe mediocre success. But with your instructions, I'm going to try them again, Sarah, and I'll let you know how it goes. And I'm sure, like all listeners, I would love to know how we get on the sign-up list to be sent those same pots that you give your daughters every year. Is that
Oh, yeah. that would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Lucky daughters, lucky daughters. With us coming towards the end, I would love to have you kind of walk us through maybe three summer pot combinations that are just truly dreamy for you. Walk us through what those plants might be, what those colors might be, and the emotional response you hope they give to people. And this will help listeners kick off their own May and Junes with something to visualize.
Yes. So for a large pot, I absolutely love the combination of a dahlia. And here I'm going to go a sort of honey, sort of orange color. And the one that I'm thinking of in my head right now is a variety called Totally Tangerine. But it's what's called an anemone flower dahlia, which is fantastic for pollinators. The butterflies and bees love it. It's very, very long flowering. It comes into flower way earlier than lots. So here it will start flowering at the end of June, and it goes on flowering till the end of November with a bit of deadheading. So that is my kind of bride. And then the bridesmaid is a very elegant airy grass, which is an annual grass you grow from seed, called Panicum Frosted Explosion. And it looks like spun sugar in a French pâtisserie. It's very, very delicate. And the brilliant thing about it is, unlike most grasses and grains, it actually is equivalent of cut and come again. So it forms axillary buds with more flowers. So you can either leave them to go honey-coloured and sort of almost like very delicate corn, or you can actually deadhead them and then you will get new, fresher, greener spun sugar. So you've got your honey-coloured dahlia and your honey-coloured grass and filling between. And then the gatecrasher here would be a salvia. And it could be any of the blue salvias, really. But there's a whole new series that's emerging, first of all, initially from New Zealand, and then it's coming to Europe via the Netherlands. And I'm sure it'll be in the States soon, which are called the Lake Series. But I'm sure you will have blue salvias. We have one for ages called Amistad, which is why you need a large pot because it's tall.
Yes.
But Lake Onager is half the size of Amistad. So that is a really lovely combination. So the next combination I'm thinking of, again, includes a dahlia, but a very blousy one. And I would go for, in fact, the one named after my daughter, which I've bred, called Molly Raven. And that is my bride. And here I've got a climbing frame with an annual climber growing up through and above her. And that's the purple bellvine or rhodochiton. And then filling between is a really lovely seed-grown annual called hibiscus mahogany, which gives some verticality, but also cascades down in a very nice way, as does the purple bellvine. So you've got something that goes up like a pillar and something that comes down like a spiller. And then you've got the foliage of the hibiscus, which is the filler. And then the Molly Raven dahlia is the thriller. So that's a different recipe, that obeys the colour rules, but also you've got the different forms. So you've got thriller, filler, pillar, and spiller. And that works incredibly well. And the final one, I think I would have to say for fragrance, would be a pelargonium, one of the scented leaf pelargoniums. And I use these as table runners. So I just have them in terracotta pots, slightly different sizes, all the way down our outside eating table in the summer. And my favorite of all is Attar of Roses, which is the basis of huge amounts in the perfume industry, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Oh, I am dreaming of my summer pots right now, Sarah.
Good.
Thank you so much for your many years of shared passion and teaching and just fun.
Right.
I hope everyone gets a chance to look at a year full of pots. And thank you so much for your time and being a guest.
Oh, well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Sarah Raven is a world-renowned gardener, cook, and author. For closing in on three decades, she has inspired the garden world with her passion for good plants, wonderful color, delicious food, and beautiful flowers from her home and working garden, Perch Hill, based in East Sussex, England. Join us again next week when we're in conversation with another garden and farm voice, Bevan Cohen of Small House Farm, based in Sanford, Michigan. There at Small House Farm, the garden is at the heart of all that they do. Raise a family, care for the land, save seeds, and share their many lessons learned. That's next week, right here. Listen in. Cultivating Place is a co-production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio, licensed to Chico State Enterprises. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by listeners just like you. Our work is also made possible through the generosity of the Caddo Shaw Foundation. The Cultivating Place team includes producer and engineer Matt Fidler, tech and web support from Angel Hiracha, weekly show transcripts by Doulis Transcription, and we're based on the traditional and present homelands of the Machupta Indian tribe of the Chico Rancheria. Original theme music is by Ma Muse. Until next week, enjoy the cultivation of your place. I'm Jennifer Jewell.